today on Against the Grain. Over the last 25 years, mothers have found themselves in the crosshairs of the legal system, blamed for a wide range of risks to their children and unborn fetuses. Cases have abounded where pregnant women have been committed out of suspicion of behavior that might affect their fetus, or even charged with murder after having a miscarriage. They've also been charged with insufficiently protecting their children from abusive fathers, rather than charging the fathers themselves. I'm Sasha Lilly. Legal scholar Linda Fentiman will join me to discuss the attack on mothers, especially poor mothers and mothers of color. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. We live in a society where it's easy to blame mothers, whether it's for their kids' misbehavior or their grown-up offspring's psychological angst following Sigmund Freud. But it's not just a cultural bias. There's a war on mothers in the courtroom. Take the case of a pregnant woman in New York who was involved in a car accident and charged with manslaughter when her daughter died after being born prematurely, or a mentally disabled woman who was charged with murder after declining a C-section and giving birth to a stillborn child. In her book, Blaming Mothers, American Law and the Risk to Children's Health, my guest today, Linda Fentiman, writes extensively about the legal system's demonization of mothers and how it takes the state off the hook for the welfare of children. She's professor at the Elizabeth Haub Law School at Pace University. Linda, let me get this question out of the way. Although it's shifted somewhat, women are still the primary caretakers of children in this society. So what's wrong with holding mothers responsible for the welfare of their children?
There's nothing wrong with holding an individual mother responsible for her child's health and welfare if, in fact, she is the cause of a particular illness or injury. But the reason I wrote this book and why I talk about blaming mothers is that in many instances, the mother is not really the source of harm or risk to her child, but instead it is other people. Sometimes it's the mother's husband or partner or other men. And frequently it's also more distant sources, corporations who spew out mercury into the atmosphere, or landlords or manufacturers of lead paint who have knowingly exposed young children to very toxic levels of lead. And sometimes it's the government who is really the source of harm to children, either through action or inaction. And in inaction, I focus especially on the government's failure to intervene in cases of intimate partner violence or domestic violence. And so my concern is that we should not immediately, unconsciously assume that because something happened to a child that it is the mother's fault always.
Give us some examples then. And we'll talk a lot during the course of this hour about how this plays out, but you're making the argument that women disproportionately bear the brunt of blame as it gets meted out in the legal system for the harms that come to children. And before we get into the particulars of all sorts of examples that you give in your book, I wonder if you could talk about the origins of the notion that women are primarily responsible for children's welfare.
Well, that could be a very, very long story, since historically mothers tended to be the ones who took care of children, certainly in Western societies. I think in the United States, we've always culturally expected mothers to not just be the primary caretakers, but to be extraordinarily nurturing and caring, to do really the absolute most they could to protect their children from everything, from every kind of risk. I would say that really, since Roe versus Wade was decided, there has been an increased emphasis on mothers and mothers' bodies as a source of potential harm to their children. And although we live in a society in which many, many women of young children work both by choice and out of economic necessity, in fact, we still expect the mother to do everything to protect her children, even if she can't be there for economic or other reasons.
Well, let's talk about to what degree does the blaming of mothers and the criminalization of mothers intersect with the politics of abortion and the attendant politics around abortion to do with the rights of fetuses. How much does this focus tend to come into play to do with pregnant women and the rights of the mother versus the fetus inside her?
So I think the most obvious example of blaming mothers is blaming them before they're mothers, which is really the civil commitment and criminal prosecution of pregnant women. And this has evolved really historically over the last several decades, coinciding with the pushback against abortion access, so that as soon as we were able to visualize the fetus and see the fetus as an entity separate from the mother, it became easier to look at the actions of a pregnant woman and say, aha, she is engaging in behavior which might be risky to the developing fetus. So in 1964, Life magazine showed for the first time to the American public the photographs taken of a developing fetus in the womb. And although these were colorized photographs, not totally accurate, they presented the fetus as a separate entity. The mother's body was literally erased from the photograph. And I think that began the ability to visualize the fetus as a completely separate entity. Today, fetal ultrasounds are ubiquitous. They're passed around at baby showers. They're posted on refrigerators. Everybody wants to know the gender of the fetus before it's born. And so they become very real prior to birth. And what we forget is that pregnancy is always somewhat risky. There are always miscarriages and stillbirths. And for many of those, we don't know medically what the cause is. Miscarriage and stillbirth are disproportionately present among African American women and poor women generally. And this, of course, is not surprising since they often suffer from poor nutrition and other social and economic factors that make it more likely that they will not be able to bring a pregnancy to term, especially the lack of access to good, high-quality prenatal care. So in terms of how this has played out over the last, say, 40 plus years since Roe versus Wade was decided, we see that beginning in the 1970s, and it was actually in California, was the first case in which a pregnant woman was prosecuted for using an opioid drug, heroin. And in that case, the appellate court decided that no, she could not be prosecuted for her drug use while pregnant as child abuse because a fetus was not a child. And then in the 1980s and early 1990s, when there was the so-called crack baby epidemic, there were a number of other prosecutions of pregnant women for their drug use while pregnant. And so in many states, women were prosecuted for delivering drugs to a minor. And that was because a drug could literally move from the mother's body to the new baby's body through the umbilical cord before it was clamped, or other kinds of child endangerment. And women were prosecuted whether or not the just born child had suffered any harm. What happened after that was that almost every court of every state that addressed this issue struck down these convictions, again on the ground that an unborn child was not a person and therefore could not be a child that could be abused in the womb. And this stopped many prosecutions for years. And then beginning in the late 1990s, prosecutors in South Carolina did two things. One is that they colluded with healthcare professionals, particularly nurses at the Charleston City Hospital, and they arranged to have all women who met certain criteria to be tested for drugs and to have their infants tested for drugs. These were only women in the public ward of Charleston City Hospital. So poor people, basically, poor women who are on Medicaid. And the criteria that were chosen to identify the women who should be tested, in fact, targeted poor women because they included things like lack of prenatal care. Well, if you're poor, you don't get prenatal care until late in your pregnancy when Medicaid will pay for it. And the other thing that happened in South Carolina was that a young woman who was intellectually disabled was using cocaine after her mother died as a response to depression. And this young woman, Regina McKnight, suffered a stillbirth at 37 weeks, and the prosecution charged her with murder, child abuse by neglect, and she was convicted by a jury, and she was sentenced to 20 years in prison. The South Carolina Supreme Court upheld her conviction. And as a result of this, prosecutors around the country were emboldened to bring other prosecutions against pregnant women who use drugs, and either their child was stillborn or they suffered a miscarriage, or in some cases a child was born but died a few days later. And so then there was a rash of prosecutions around the country in states like Oklahoma and Hawaii, Mississippi, and a number of other states, Texas, Maryland. And again, in all states but South Carolina and Alabama, these prosecutions were found to be invalid by the highest court in that state.
You mentioned the case of a pregnant woman, Alicia Beltran, who was civilly committed for 79 days based on her prior history of drug use, not current history at the time, but prior history, because of the harm that she might cause her fetus. Tell us about that case.
So Alicia Beltran was a Wisconsin woman who went for her first prenatal care appointment at about 12 weeks, and she met with a nurse practitioner who took a detailed medical history. And Ms. Beltran was candid about the fact that she had felt that she was addicted to an opioid drug, but she weaned herself off it by using another drug, Suboxone, which is commonly used to help people withdraw safely from opioid use. What happened in that case is after Ms. Beltran confided in the nurse practitioner wanted to insist that she continue with Suboxone, and Ms. Beltran said, no, I don't want to. And because I am drug-free, I don't want to use another drug. And in fact, her drug test confirmed this. So Ms. Beltran went home and 2 days later was arrested by the police, handcuffed, taken to county jail. And then she appeared in handcuffs in front of the judge. And she was unable to have an attorney represent her, although the district attorney was there representing the county in the name of the fetus. And after a very short hearing, Ms. Beltran was civilly committed against her will, sent several hours away from her home so that she lost her job. And it really wasn't until National Advocates for Pregnant Women brought a suit, a habeas corpus petition asking her to be released, that the prosecution dropped the charges against her. And I think what people don't realize is how common this is. So it is permissible under the laws of more than 30 states to have a woman committed as either mentally ill or abusing substances to be committed to either a mental health institution or some other kind of confinement simply because she's using drugs. And of course, the most risky drug for a developing fetus is alcohol, and yet it is primarily illegal drugs, street drugs, and prescription drugs like opioids that are being used, that those women are being the subject of prosecution.
Linda Fentiman is my guest. She's a legal scholar and author of Blaming Mothers. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, and I'm Sasha Lilly. So you just mentioned that the focus on drug use is disproportionately about illegal drugs, which obviously aren't good for mother or fetus, but that don't have the same severity of impact of a legal drug like alcohol. What do we know about that, the impact of drugs during pregnancy? And what would you say about how there's a focus on one and not the other? What sort of implications also are there in terms of the kind of prosecutions that take place in terms of race and class, which always come up as issues when drugs are evoked?
So let me, I think, answer your second question first. In fact, drug use of all kinds occurs across the economic spectrum among all social classes and among all races. Dr. Ira Chazanoff, who is a neonatologist in California, has written extensively about the fact that women of all social circumstances use drugs. They may use different drugs. So middle-class women are more likely to use and abuse alcohol, particularly wine. And poorer women, inner-city women, are more likely to use illicit drugs, street drugs. What we know about the harm is, unfortunately, not enough. We do know, for example, that in some cases a woman who consumes large amounts of alcohol gives birth to a child who has what's called fetal alcohol syndrome, and this child may suffer from intellectual disabilities, may have different facial features, and may have cardiac problems, a number of related adverse health effects. However, studies have shown that middle-class women are less likely to deliver children suffering from fetal alcohol syndrome, suggesting strongly that it is not only alcohol, but something else is going on. And even in South Africa, where many, many women are poor, they have compared women in different communities, and they find that women whose diet is less adequate are more likely to deliver children born with fetal alcohol syndrome. In terms of the other drugs that are frequently used by pregnant women, and I want to interrupt for just a minute to say that of course pregnant women use drugs because women of childbearing age are also at the age at which everybody is more likely to use drugs. So I would say that most pregnant women, virtually all pregnant women, try very hard to either eliminate or decrease their drug use. But sometimes it is not possible for them, again, often because of very difficult social circumstances. But going back to illicit drugs, there have been longitudinal studies done of the so-called crack babies from the late 1980s. And now that these children are in their 20s, the researchers have discovered that there is no difference in the health outcome or the mental status of infants who were exposed to crack cocaine in utero and the same infants born in the same hospital to mothers who were not using cocaine or other drugs. And what the study authors have concluded is that it is poverty that is the greatest risk to children's health. That when they looked at all the children born at particular hospitals, the ones who had the worst health outcomes and the ones who had the more life troubles were the children born to the poorest mothers. And I think this is exactly the kind of social factor, economic factor, that is often overlooked when we're talking about prosecuting pregnant women for risking their children's health. I think people often are looking at this problem in isolation without realizing that what pregnant women need more than anything else is economic and social support so that they can bring a healthy baby into the world.
And yet it's precisely, as you write in your book, Blaming Mothers, it's precisely those poor women, women of color, who are being disproportionately targeted for the kind of criminalization that you've been detailing.
Yes, very much so. And in a study that was also done by Dr. Chasanoff in Florida in the 1990s, he found that physicians were 10 times more likely to report their African-American patients for drug testing than they were to recommend that their white patients be recommended for drug testing. So there's clearly an unconscious, if not conscious, racial bias in the selection of pregnant women and mothers who are seen as potentially risking their children's health. Of course, the countervailing observation is that these women are precisely those who have the least access to resources. So they are unlikely to have health care that would give them access to substance abuse treatment. And one of the interesting things about the recent demise of the Republican effort to repeal the Affordable Care Act is that so many people were benefiting from the Medicaid expansion because it covered inpatient treatment for opioid abuse. But this is exactly the kind of treatment that is often denied pregnant women. And unless you're middle class and have a good health care plan, you are unable to afford it on your own.
How common is the kinds of reporting that you've just mentioned in a few of the examples you've given of medical staff, nurses, doctors, basically reporting on their patients as being a danger to unborn fetuses or to children?
Well, I think it is becoming more common. I don't have precise percentages of patients who are reported, but I think since the 1970s, when physicians, teachers, and others became mandatory reporters under state child abuse laws, that in fact many healthcare providers, nurses, physicians, and other healthcare staff feel that they have an obligation to support a suspicion of child abuse. They want to err on the side of safety and protect a child who they see might be at risk. And of course, if it's a fetus, many people view a fetus as a child, as the equivalent of a child, and so they may report their patients. An interesting example happened in Iowa in 2010. Christine Taylor was pregnant and fell down the stairs, and she went to the local hospital emergency room and was seen because she wanted to make sure that the fetus was developing appropriately and had not been injured in her fall. When one of the hospital staff asked her how she felt about this pregnancy, she admitted that she felt a little ambivalent because her husband had just abandoned her and her two young children, and she was concerned about how she would survive. One of the hospital workers reported Ms. Taylor to the police, and they exercised their discretion and arrested her for attempted feticide on the basis of her ambiguous statement that she wasn't sure how she felt about her pregnancy at this particular moment. So I think a lot of healthcare providers are really deciding that they themselves are able to interpret the law and are choosing to report pregnant women for conduct which is really very innocuous and only human.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with Linda Fentiman. She's a professor at the Elizabeth Howe Law School at Pace University and author of Blaming Mothers, American Law and the Risk to Children's Health, which is published by NYU Press, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. So one of the things that comes up in this discussion about mothers being demonized, mothers being criminalized and even prosecuted, is how the legal establishment and the medical establishment define risk. How is risk calculated? How arbitrary is that category?
Risk is a very ambiguous and open-ended term. I like to say that risk, like beauty, is in the eye of the beholder. And the fact is that each of us has a different conception of risk. Risk is not simply a number that can be deduced by looking at the dose level of an exposure and calculating the time of exposure and the different method of exposure. Even though we try to do that, risk is heavily influenced by our worldviews, whether we think that the world is a very safe place, whether we think that we have egalitarian ideals or communitarian ideals, or whether we're more hierarchical and more individualist. Each of those worldviews has a different view about risk. One finding that has been repeatedly made by scholars and researchers in psychology is something called the white male effect. And this is the finding that about 30% of all white men basically find nothing to be risky. And this may be attributable to their hierarchical or individualist worldviews. Women of all races and African American women and men do find things more risky, perhaps because they have seen more environmental or other harm in their lives. And so what happens with risk when we're looking at children's health or we're looking at the health of a developing fetus in a pregnant woman is that we tend to look backwards. There's something called the hindsight bias, which is that if something bad has happened, we believe that it was always foreseeable that it would happen. But that is not statistically the case. And so when we're looking at pregnancy, it is true as a biological fact of life that everything a woman does can affect her pregnancy and can affect the health of her developing fetus. But it is not true or not appropriate for physicians, judges, and prosecutors to decide that a woman's behavior is so risky that she should either be civilly committed to protect the developing fetus, or that she should be forced to undergo a C-section or other mandatory medical treatment because the physician believes that she is doing something that is risky for the developing fetus.
Well, it's interesting you just mentioned cesareans, and in the United States, about a third of babies are delivered by C-section, which is more dangerous for the mother than a vaginal birth would be. So it also appears that the medical profession is often, in advocating for cesarean sections, putting the perceived risks and health of the baby over that of the mother.
Yes, and I think this is also an historical evolution. For many years, of course, physicians, like everybody else, did not know exactly what was going on during pregnancy, during gestation. And so when a baby was born, it was always a surprise. Not that it was unexpected, but the details of its health would be unknown. And so up until about the 1950s or early 1960s, most obstetricians in the United States believed that the best way to have a healthy baby was to have a healthy mother. And they treated the mother, the pregnant woman, and the developing fetus as a unit. And they had to treat the mother well in order to have a healthy baby. Now, increasingly, physicians are risk averse. Partly that is because they like every other physician, does not want to be sued for medical malpractice, and they want to minimize the chance of a bad birth outcome. Partly it is due to electronic fetal monitoring, which was developed in the early 1960s in an effort to identify those fetuses that were at risk during labor and to identify those fetuses who should be delivered early in order to avoid a traumatic vaginal birth. But what happened, in fact, is that electronic fetal monitoring is wrong half the time. But of course, physicians don't know which half of the time it will be wrong. And so they are very likely to decide when there's any sign of risk from the electronic fetal monitoring or other indications that they must deliver the baby by cesarean. And it's not that women want to risk the delivery of a baby that has been deprived of oxygen, for example, but women have the right as autonomous individuals to choose what kind of medical treatment they would like. And it's very dangerous for physicians to be given the power to insist that a woman have a C-section because the physician is concerned about the risk. The same thing happens in terms of babies who are predicted to be too large to be delivered vaginally. And there have been cases in which a physician wanted to insist on a C-section for a woman who is carrying a large baby. And in many, many cases, those women have gone to other hospitals and have had a perfectly normal delivery. And so part of it is the idea that women should be able to make their own healthcare decisions and not fear that if they disagree with the physician, that the physician will seek a court order mandating a certain method of delivery.
We've been talking a lot about the way that pregnant women have been criminalized. Let's talk about the myriad cases that have taken place to do with women and their children who are born. What are some examples that you've encountered of the ways that women have been demonized for insufficiently protecting their children?
Well, I think one interesting case is that of Bridget Cavain, who was a university professor in Montana. And one day her 12-year-old daughter and the daughter's 12-year-old friend wanted the mom, the professor, to take them to the mall. And the mother said, no, I don't want to take you to the mall. And the daughters volunteered that they would watch over their younger siblings if the mother would only drop them at the mall. And so the mother decided that was a good exercise in responsible behavior for her daughter. And so she allowed her daughter to go to the mall. And while the children were at the mall, while they were at Macy's, the older two daughters temporarily ignored a 5-year-old, and the store detectives discovered this and called the police. And ultimately, the mother was arrested for child endangerment because she let her daughters watch over the other children at a mall, even though they were only 5 minutes away. And in this case, the mother wanted to go to trial and assert that she had not been reckless about her children's health and safety. But in fact, she was persuaded by a mock jury that her lawyer conducted that she would likely be found guilty. And so she did plead guilty to avoid a lengthy jail sentence. Other cases involve women who are the victims of domestic violence, and it is often their husband or partner who abuses them and also may be abusing their child. And in very tragic cases in which the partner or husband severely injured or killed the child, the mothers who did not engage in any kind of abusive activity are prosecuted themselves for manslaughter or murder because they failed to protect their children from the abuse.
Which raises all sorts of questions, but one is about where fathers are in this story. I mean, even when they're not perpetrating physical abuse, why things are directed at the mothers and not the fathers?
Well, again, I think it is unconscious biases that we expect mothers and not fathers to be on the scene, to be supervising their children at all times. And so it's really our cultural values, our cultural norms become translated into the law so that even objective and neutral terms, like the concept of negligence, which is falling below the standard of the reasonable person, become transformed by a prosecutor, by a judge, by a jury, into the idea of the reasonable mother. And the reasonable mother is really expected to be almost omnipotent. She is supposed to be extraordinarily caring, extraordinarily self-sacrificing. And so it's easier to blame the mother than it is to look at the underlying economic and social situation in which many mothers and fathers of children find themselves without adequate resources to do the best job possible in nurturing their children.
I'm speaking with Linda Fentiman. She is a professor of law at Pace University and the author of Blaming Mothers. We're talking about that today. I'm Sasha Lilly, and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, this turn toward criminalizing mothers seems to coincide with a number of things. One is a sort of societal shift towards a more unequal society where fathers and mothers are working more hours and there are fewer social supports. At the same time, there seem to be these moments of panic that get fanned by the media about children's well-being with apparently absentee mothers. What do we know about the well-being of children today in historical perspective in the United States?
So what we know is that actually American children are healthier on average than they have been ever historically. So that most American children will be born healthy and will grow up healthy and will live very long lives. However, the underlying economic and racial disparities that exist in our healthcare system and in our society at large mean that some children are much more likely to face health risks both before birth, after birth, and as they grow into adulthood. So that although the United States used to be the leader in the world in terms of life expectancy, in terms of infant mortality, i.e. having a very low infant mortality rate, in fact, the United States is falling further and further behind its developed neighbors, that Canada has much lower infant mortality. France has lower infant mortality. I think the United States, in terms of preterm birth, which is another indication of a not healthy pregnancy, is right up there with Turkey and maybe Rwanda. So the healthcare resources are not distributed equally in this country. So part of the problem is the lack of healthcare access, but part of the problem is really the larger environment in which American children are born. So for example, all European countries banned the use of lead paint in the early years of the 20th century. 1909, 1912, 1919 was probably the latest year. In the United States, the manufacturers of lead paint lobbied very hard in state legislatures and at the federal level to continue to be able to market lead-based paint, even though they were well aware that lead-based paint would flake, would deteriorate, and would expose children to very high levels of lead, and that these children would become ill and in some cases die. So part of what's going on in the United States is that we take a very individualistic approach to children's health and family health, and we expect every parent, and particularly every mother, to take care of her children without resources. We have a kind of up by one's bootstraps attitude, and we don't have, generally speaking, a caring community in which people with less material resources, less social support, less healthcare support are taken care of, are given those supports by the government and by others in their community. So that every mother has to fend for herself. And this contributes to the problems of less healthy children in the United States. So whether you're looking in the inner city or you're looking in poor rural areas, you see that poverty is connected with a number of poor health outcomes. These include child abuse, lead exposure, substance abuse, and mental illness, and other indicia of poor child and maternal health. And it is really the case that until we address the fundamental problem of poverty, we're not going to be able to have all Americans, children and adults, continue to have healthier lives.
We're running out of time, but I want to ask you about the role of the legal system in demonizing mothers, criminalizing mothers, and not looking at the bigger picture, which you just laid out for us, of all the social factors that contribute to the status of children in America today. What role do judges in particular play?
Well, I think we have to remember that judges are people like the rest of us. And so judges and prosecutors and juries all have their own individual biases, which are often unconscious. And they are making discretionary decisions, interpreting the law, whether it is a law defining child neglect using the reasonable person standard or the reasonable mother, or they're sentencing mothers after they have been convicted. And so it's not surprising that if prejudices and unconscious biases affect everyone, they also affect key legal decision makers like judges, like prosecutors. I want to emphasize that it's not intentional. It is not that prosecutors are choosing to go out of their way and prosecute poor women, women of color, but it is their unconscious biases in terms of the cognitive shortcuts they take, in terms of their unconscious economic bias or color bias that really play out as they evaluate a particular situation and decide that a particular woman, whether she's pregnant or whether she's already a mother, has fallen below the standard of the reasonable person or the reasonable mother. And it's precisely because we are unaware of these biases that they have such powerful effects.
Let me end by asking you about what you see in the near to middle future. It's obviously the early days of the Trump administration, but there are various indicators of the direction it's going in. Are you concerned that the tendency toward demonizing women and mothers in particular will intensify, or do you see it, the future, as being part of a continuum of the recent past? What's your best guess?
Well, my best guess is really based not on the Trump administration, but on the factors that led to President Trump's election, because we have to remember that every prosecutorial decision is taken at the local level. And one of the things that is different in the American legal system compared to the Canadian or French or English legal systems is that prosecutors are elected, not appointed, officials. And so prosecutors often make decisions to prosecute at least partly, at least unconsciously, on the idea that this may advance their political career. So I think that it is more likely that pregnant women and other women, overwhelmingly poor and overwhelmingly women of color, will continue to be prosecuted. And this is true not only in red states, but also blue states. A number of foreign-born women have lately been prosecuted in Indiana in particular. But it is a disturbing trend, and it will continue, I think, until we acknowledge that every child needs basic economic and social supports, and that the best way to have healthy children is to support pregnant women and mothers and make it possible for them to be the most nurturing and caring that they can be. And it, of course, is particularly difficult in tough economic times because mothers, most mothers have to work for economic reasons, and it makes it impossible for them to be omnipotent, always overseeing everything their child does, even though such helicopter parenting is probably not a good idea in any case.
What can listeners do beyond trying to shift society in that kind of more major way you're describing, where the collective good is being actually nurtured? But in terms of the prosecution of mothers around the country, is there any kind of action that you would recommend that people take who might be concerned with what they've heard in this past hour?
Yes, I think that listeners could support financially and in other ways National Advocates for Pregnant Women, which is a very effective organization, and that whenever a woman is prosecuted, that listeners ask themselves, could they find themselves in that situation? And if it seems possible that there is a class or color bias at play here, then they should be writing to their representatives and they should be writing to their local newspapers to make their voices heard. Because I think prosecutors are very sensitive to public opinion. And if the public does not agree with a particular prosecution, then the prosecutor is likely to back off. So I think don't sit back and just observe this disparate treatment of mothers and fathers, but actually speak up about it.
I've been speaking with legal scholar Linda Fentiman. She teaches at the Elizabeth Haub Law School at Pace University, and she's the author of Blaming Mothers, American Law and the Risk to Children's Health, which is published by New York University Press, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.